This lecture is intended as an introduction to three texts that we will be studying. The Dream of Scipio by Cicero, a text that predates Christianity and comes from the end of the Roman Republic and the beginning of the Roman Empire. The correspondence between Trajan and Pliny, which reflects the perplexity on the part of the ruling authority in regard to this new religion of Christianity and how to deal with it. And then the Apology of Justin Martyr, which is a reflection of an intellectual Christian response both to Roman tradition and the development of persecution of Christianity, and an attempt as well to suggest that pagan philosophy finds its fulfillment, its proper fulfillment in Christian thought, an opinion that will not go unchallenged, as we shall see. So this lecture is really intended to remind us of a little bit of the history of Rome and its empire, and also to begin to look at several of the connections that are necessary in order to appreciate the significance of the texts we will be looking at. If you look at what is initially on this page, you will see that under the pictures of the Forum and the Emperor Augustus is a timeline that begins in about 500 BC and reaches to the time of Christ. Below that, under the two pictures that follow it, the pictures of the offering of incense to the deities, is a timeline of the first century, and beneath that, a timeline of the second century. And we'll be referring to these during the course of this discussion. If we could look at the first timeline, the one that involves a multicolored text immediately under, at the top of the page, the words Precursors of the Roman Republic. This is a reminder to us of the fact that the Roman Empire, which is more or less colored in red, that is the figures that are of most importance, Scipio, Julius Caesar, Augustus, and Cicero himself are in shades of red, Rome effectively inherits an empire created by the Greeks, an empire which was created by Alexander and his generals centuries before, and which represented the triumph of military genius based in Greece, but also an occasion in which Greek literature and philosophy and lifestyle was exported throughout the Mediterranean and even into the Far East. The wars of conquest had with them a particular mindset and approach, particularly spearheaded by Alexander, in which local culture was not really oppressed or suppressed, but rather the local traditions and even deities and religious practices were in a certain sense embraced by the conquerors, and a kind of willingness to learn from and also to teach what had been available and which was available in the Greek Empire, particularly the philosophical writings and especially the Greek language, were very much characteristics of the empire which Alexander envisioned, but which really didn't outlive the lives of his generals. The empire quickly fragmented, and the various divisions within it became intriguing examples of a fusion between Hellenistic or Greek culture and the indigenous culture. The one with which we will be most concerned in this course is the culture that was found in Egypt as a result of the combination of General Ptolemy's approach to Hellenization with the already beginning to decay religion of ancient Egypt, which resulted in an intriguing fusion that is characterized by what one finds in the stories and descriptions of Egypt during the reign of Cleopatra and Ptolemy, just at the time of Julius Caesar. But that's an aside. That's simply by way of saying that Rome, in its wars of conquest and its development, found, as it were, an empire or a world already united by Greek language and literature and ready for the kind of unification which the Roman genius could bring to bear and which the Hellenistic approach did not. The Roman approach did not seek the same kind of amalgamation of cultures. Although Rome was more than willing to add new deities to their pantheon, there was a real jealousy of Roman tradition and a strong sense that it was the gods and religious traditions of Rome that made Rome strong. And so veneration of these deities was a part of support of the ruling elite, but also a kind of affirmation of the right of Rome to supremacy. And so the what will become very problematic encouragement of or requirement for sacrifice to Roman deities in the provinces, and which will be a particular issue for Christians, was seen by the Roman conquerors not primarily as a religious or, as we might call it, a theological or spiritual issue, but much more a political question. You demonstrated your loyalty to Rome. You demonstrated your acknowledgement of the superiority of Rome by offering reverence to Roman deities, including deified Roman emperors. And of course, Christians, as we'll see, were unable to do this, and that resulted in the clash that very much accelerated the persecution of Christians in the 3rd century, especially, as we'll see in the next section of our course. But for our purposes here, the point is to remind ourselves that there was a difference in approach which Rome had from that which Greece had had, or which Alexander had had, in how to approach conquered nations. And of course, the conquered nation with which we're primarily concerned is Israel. Israel had been under the domination of the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Persians when Alexander's power was finally manifest. And of course, Israel came under the domination of Greece in the period just before the Maccabean rule and revolt, which was to a large extent induced by a kind of rather more aggressive Hellenization, which was powerfully resisted by Judaism. Then, of course, the wars of conquest, particularly of Julius Caesar, and to some extent of Octavian, then Augustus, united and created a new imperial power, a new form of oppression for Israel. And this nation, which had been under the heel of other rulers for many centuries, now came under the sway of Rome. And that was the condition at the time of the birth of Christ. Rome had shifted from being a republic to some extent prior to the rise of Julius Caesar. The Senate still did have power, despite the very powerful generals and dictators who had come to power prior to his time. But after the time of Julius, even though it would be some time before Romans could bring themselves to admit that they were effectively an empire, they hated the word king and the idea of having a king, but the reality is that Octavian, or Augustus, as he becomes known, is an emperor in the full sense of the word, even though he constantly claims to be one who is supporting the ideals of the Republic, and he maintained during his reign the mythology that he would at some point restore the Republic in its full form, with real power to the Senate and less authority to an imperial figure or into an imperial family. However, Augustus institutes the Roman Empire in the strict sense of the word in terms of its political structures. And from that time onward, rule is by an individual much more than it is by the Senate. The Senate becomes more and more an institution for agreeing with the emperor rather than setting policy, and it more or less disappears in significance and even in real form by the 3rd and certainly by the 4th centuries. A point that I wanted to make here was that as Christianity develops, it develops into this matrix, and there is this sense of longing within Roman society for an older, more golden age of republic, but a slow acknowledgement of the existence now of empire. And the text that we'll be looking at from the pen of Cicero is by someone who himself supported the republic and regretted tremendously the increasing power of Julius Caesar, and his opposition to imperial rule was in fact one of the reasons why he was proscribed and forced to commit suicide by Antony with the agreement of Octavian Augustus. We'll look at Cicero's text, which is a kind of longing for a recovery of moral values within the context of service to the state, but still with a sense of the importance of a kind of sense of humility in regard to ruling authority. The next text that we'll look at after that brings us into the era of the persecution of Christians, which we will consider in more detail in our next section. We will be looking at the correspondence between the emperor Trajan and his governor Pliny. This gives us a very interesting insight into the efforts on the part of the Roman authority to some extent understand what Christianity was about and to develop patterns of legally dealing with this new religion. As we will see, if you drop down now to the timeline that shows the first century, Claudian dynasty, which is represented by the emperors from Augustus through Nero, didn't really have much to do with Christianity, except that the first persecution of Christians, as we'll see under Nero, took place in the city of Rome and was confined exclusively to Rome. It was not an empire-wide persecution, and it did not create any imperial proscription of Christian religion. However, there is some suggestion that it created a precedent that Christianity was a religion that would be regarded as illegal if someone publicly professed it. So the next dynasty, the Flavian dynasty, as we'll see, was much more concerned with the problem of Judaism. The Jewish rebellion, culminating in the destruction of the temple, was the responsibility of, or a part of the work of Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian. And to some extent, Christianity was thought of as being a part of Judaism during this period, but it was in the next dynasty, the Antonines, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and in particular in Marcus Aurelius, that Christianity became identified as a phenomenon of its own. And it was during this period that the apologists, particularly Justin Martyr, felt the need to try to explain Christianity using terms, images, and ideas that would be comprehensible to traditional Romans. There were persecutions, not just localized in individual cities, during the period of the so-called good emperors, the Antonines, as we shall see in the next section, and Justin Martyr perishes during the reign of Marcus Aurelius, who paradoxically has the reputation for being the most philosophical of the emperors. We might note that philosophical though he was, he apparently did not care much for Christianity, and it was during the period of these so-called good emperors that anti-Christian polemic began to develop. Christians, as we'll see, would be regarded as degenerate practitioners of an Oriental religion who not only despised mankind, but engaged in fairly abominable practices, the worshiping of a donkey, perhaps the sacrifice of children, and maybe even cannibalistic rituals. These sorts of things are attributed to Christians during this period, and to a very large extent, as we'll see, Justin Martyr wants to argue against them. With this kind of a background, let's turn to those primary texts, and then in the next section of our course, we'll turn in a bit more detail to the issue of martyrdom and its practice throughout the second through the fourth centuries.